Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today we're doing a special show on the life and legacy of Scottish psychiatrist R.D. Lang. And I'm very excited because I've invited one of Lang's students and colleagues on the show, Michael Guy Thompson. Michael Guy Thompson is a psychoanalyst. He trained with R.D. Lang, and he's also the author of The Death of Desire. He's a teacher and trainer and on the faculty of the California Institute of Integral Studies and the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California. Michael is the director of the R.D. Lang in the 21st Century Seminar, which happens every year at Esalen Institute, and he's also the founder of the Gnosis Retreat Center in the San Francisco Bay Area. So welcome to Madness Radio, Michael Guy Thompson.
Well, thank you so much, Will, for inviting me.
I'm just really excited to be doing this show on R.D. Lang, and I'm very honored to have one of his students and colleagues as a guest. Maybe people don't know R.D. Lang's work. He was extremely popular in the 60s and 70s. He's kind of associated with the radical psychiatry movement in the 60s and 70s. Had a huge influence on the psychiatric survivor movement, and an incredible, he was really a cultural icon in a lot of ways, and a deep, deep personal influence on me. And I know that he also had an influence on you, Michael. And so I think it's just fantastic to have you on the show today. And maybe we can just get started. You know, when was the first moment that you read Lang's writing? And then give us kind of an introduction to who is this character, R.D. Lang, and why was he so compelling to you that you went and studied with him and became his colleague, and that today he's so influential on your own work?
Well, it was really serendipitous, Will, how I ever heard about R.D. Lang. I was interested in philosophy as a teenager and discovered Sartre and Nietzsche. And, in that rebellious period of our lives, these kinds of people get our attention. Even Sigmund Freud, who I thought of as a very radical guy back then. And I just decided that I wanted to pursue this field of going into psychology, but from a more philosophical, existential perspective. And I was in the Army, got drafted, went to Vietnam, managed to survive that. And when I got out of the service, I decided to move to California. This would have been 1970. And walking on a beach one day, this friendly young hippie comes up to me and starts chatting and wants to know, who I am. And I mentioned I was interested in existentialism and psychoanalysis, and he pulls this book out of his backpack, looked like it had been read a million times, and hands it to me and says, "Here, I think you're going to like this." And it was a book by R.D. Lang, who I'd never heard of, called The Divided Self. And I just took a look at the back jacket of it and immediately mentions that he's a psychiatrist and works with schizophrenia and has all these radical ideas. And I was kind of put off by this because I thought, well, come on, who really wants to work with schizophrenia? So I handed the book back and he said, no, I think you're really going to like this book. And just insisted that I take it. And I took it and he wandered off, never to be heard from again. So I sit down and began to read the book and I was completely blown away. I didn't realize Lang was a philosopher, had studied virtually everything in the Western canon as well as Eastern religions. This was a really erudite, interesting, brilliant person who had an amazing gift for writing and making you feel that the things he was describing, no matter how crazy it might sound, seemed strangely familiar. He was really talking about your inner core and some of the feelings that I was certainly struggling with. So this really was an awakening for me. So I decided to start reading everything else of his. I became a devotee. And in a year or two, Lang visited Berkeley for a public lecture tour, and I got to meet him. And by this time, I was a complete convert. But once he said at his lecture, you know, I have a small group of people that I work with. If you're interested in giving up psychology, I was pretty much on the next plane to London, abandoned my graduate studies, said, you know, this is not what I'm looking for, and never looked back, you know, went there and worked with Lang for about 7 years.
Well, I think that's, you touch on one of the things that's so powerful about Lang's writing and his presence, was that the way that his capacity to communicate and to write really bridged the radical world of a lot of the philosophy of the time, especially existentialism and phenomenology, and the kind of rebellious revolutionary spirit that's going on in philosophy. He bridged it through writing that was very clear and very compelling, and people could understand. He was a very popular. You could pick up a paperback and people were reading him like the pop writers of the time. But let's give people a flavor of why we think this is so interesting, why we want to encourage the listeners to get interested in R.D. Lang and read some of his work. Just some quotes that I have. One of the most basic things about Lang is that he was really a champion of rendering what's called schizophrenia or what's called psychosis as intelligible in context. And so one of his quotes is, "The experience and behavior that gets labeled schizophrenia is a special strategy that a person invents in order to live in an unlivable situation." Now, there's so much in that that critiques the prevailing medical view of what schizophrenia and psychosis are, and he's drawing on the work of Irving Goffman, he's drawing on the work of Gregory Bateson, but he's able to put it in such a clear and powerful way and then convey it to readers. And was this part of what captured your interest and attention when you started reading The Divided Self?
Oh, absolutely, Will. When I started reading psychology and what passes for clinical psychology, my mind was just numbed. The terminology, even in the psychoanalytic literature, you just have to wade through this copious stuff, you know, that's so abstract or mind-numbing, you can hardly understand what they're talking about. Lang just cut right through that with comments like this that you just quoted. You know, he also takes from Freud, but much more eloquently. Freud was the first person to say that what we call defense mechanisms and psychopathological symptoms, whether they're neurotic or psychotic, you know, which is a great divide in the world of psychoanalysis, that the reason we become neurotic in the first place is to try to heal ourselves. You know, we've reached our limit. We can't cope anymore with whatever it is that the world is throwing at us. And for the most part, you know, we manage to navigate and handle what the world throws to us without getting completely overwhelmed by it. But a lot of people, as we don't know how many, maybe most of us, find this incredibly challenging. We lose our balance. We take a fall. Why is that? You know, and we've kind of pathologized it. We've made it into a psychiatric medical symptom of some kind of a disease entity. Lang just cuts right through that idea by calling it a strategy that we use our minds to try to protect ourselves from something that's scaring the daylights out of us. And that's what gets labeled schizophrenia, psychosis, neurosis, you name it. And that's Lang's gift. He can put it in that way.
And that experience that someone is confronting and trying to deal with and that overwhelms and is actually called normal society. It's called normal,
exactly.
The normal family. So he says that we are all in a post-hypnotic trance induced in early infancy. From the moment of birth, when the Stone Age baby confronts the 20th century mother, the baby is subjected to these forces of violence called love, as the mother and father have been, and their parents before them. These forces are mainly concerned with destroying most of the child's potentialities. This enterprise is on the whole successful.
That's one of my favorite quotes you just read from The Politics of Experience. Of course, Lange was very influenced by Marxist theory, as all intellectuals were in that era. And that idea that society is destroying us and making us more alienated, and we don't even know it's happening, is really a critique of capitalism and just how greedy and selfish capitalism can be when it's run amok, as we see right now in 2017. It's run more amok than probably ever before. This was kind of part of the social critique. Lange sometimes got accused of blaming parents, especially mothers, for people becoming diagnosed some kind of psychotic condition. Certainly many psychoanalysts took that position. But Lange attributed it to society, that we're all implicated in this. It's our value system. Why is it we don't reach out and help people that are unable to work and are just too out of it to deal with what we take for granted every day? And some societies are more generous about this than others, as you well know, especially when you get out of the U.S. But this is the predicament we have here, and it was a similar predicament that Lange was struggling with in the United Kingdom, is that there just wasn't a lot of attention and care about this, or even recognition that the way we're going about living our daily lives is driving a lot of people crazy.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Michael Guy Thompson. He is a psychoanalyst who trained with the Scottish psychiatrist R.D. Lange, and he's the author of The Death of Desire. Michael is a teacher and trainer. He's on the faculty of the California Institute for Integral Studies and on the Psychoanalytic Institute in Northern California. He's the director of the R.D. Lange in the 21st Century Seminar, which happens every year at Esalen Institute, and the founder of Gnosis Retreat Center in the San Francisco Bay Area. Yeah, he says really clearly, there's another quote from The Politics of Experience. He says, "Nor is it a matter of laying the blame at anyone's door. The untenable position, the can't-win double bind, the situation of checkmate is by definition not obvious to the protagonists. Very seldom is it a question of contrived, deliberate, cynical lies or a ruthless intention to drive someone crazy. Although," he says, "this occurs more commonly than is usually supposed."
I think that's absolutely the crux of the problem. And I think it's doubly ironic that we have set in place this entity that we call the mental health system or delivery system, where we've made the mind part of the medical praxis, and that we, that we come at this in such a way that seems almost cruel to the outside observer. You know, you see the way that in mental hospitals, for example, people are treated. Sometimes they're treated very compassionately. You know, they luck out and there's a really wonderful person there that greets them and takes care of them. But as often as not, it can be a brutal experience and very impersonal. And you're not treated as a person at all. So this is the big problem, I think, that, of course, people like Marcuse, Harry Sack Sullivan, founder of the Interpersonal School of Psychoanalysis. These are all, leftist, very educated in radical politics. They were very attuned to social issues and how social values play such a huge role in the kind of symptoms that families go to therapists for. That was a big part of psychoanalysis in its infancy. over the years, decades especially, I think, as it got Americanized, it became very conservative, and it became a tool of psychiatry, which was unusual. It never became a tool of psychiatry in the UK or many of the other countries. So really, it became this ultra-conservative delivery system intended to be lucrative. So these are the trends that seem to take a hold and evolve, and the more edgy, leftist, socially aware aspects began to die out. And now you look at psychoanalysis today, and it's virtually disappeared completely.
And Lang says that this question of adaptation is really central. One of his quotes is, "Only by the most outrageous violation of ourselves have we achieved our capacity to live in relative adjustment to a civilization apparently driven to its own destruction." So this, I think, is the main critique that he starts with, and that leads him, in a sense, to be on the side of madness. He's often accused of romanticizing madness or celebrating the madman as a revolutionary, which I don't think that he does. But he is saying that the point is not to adjust people to a society that has normalized violence, so much harm, but instead to understand where people's response comes from, and then help them to move through it in a way that's actually going to be liberating for them and then potentially liberating for the society.
Well, yeah, that's the number of the problem, and I think this is why we're stuck in this kind of dilemma that continues to this day. I remember in the 70s when I went to work with Lang, the use of ECT, electric shocks, were considered to be barbaric, and there was a huge outcry against its usage. Today, ECT is used more often, more prevalently than ever in history. There's no social outcry about this at all. And we continue to pathologize people who think and behave in ways that are a little different, and we associate being crazed, being depressed, being out of it, being beside yourself, being scared and isolated and maybe a little paranoid with being a sick person that needs to be treated. So if there's a treatment, and of course the treatment today is both for the most part medication, which is a misnomer, of course, it just sedates you, then that's all that we do. And so does that cure anything? I mean, that's what treatments are supposed to do. Well, for the most part, no, it's not going to cure anything because it isn't a pathological condition. Our minds are very fragile instruments that are constantly gauging what's going on around us. Some of us just happen to be more anxious and frightened than other people. We take more extremes to protect ourselves, and sometimes we behave in ways that seem a little eccentric or nonsensical. Why label that a medical condition that needs to be treated and cured? Why not find a way to understand what's going on with that person and welcome them into the social network instead of isolating them and abandoning them to some kind of facility?
Let's take a little bit deeper look in this idea of the normalization of violence. And Lang is very critical of what happens in families. He says that the family's role is to repress eros, that really the innate capacities of the child are being destroyed by the family. And it's not about blaming the mother or blaming the father. It's a social conditioning. One of his quotes is, "Children do not give up their innate imagination, curiosity, dreaminess easily. You have to love them to get them to do that." He was a big critic of what we call love not actually being loving and caring. Help us understand a little bit more about Lang's view of the family and misunderstanding of what love is and what families actually do to us.
Well, I think for this, Lang certainly takes a lot from Sartre, who was a brilliant commentator and observer of everyday society. You know, Lang's collaboration with Aaron Esterson produced a very interesting book called Sanity, Madness, and the Family, which was simply interviews that the two of them had conducted with families where a daughter had been diagnosed as schizophrenic and was put in a mental institution. And for a number of years, they conducted extensive interviews with the families together, the parents separated, the designated patient separated, etc. And these are fascinating because what you get is an inside scoop on what these families were like. And if you take away anything, you take away the idea that really all of these families were doing their very best to try to help this daughter, and completely out of their depth in comprehending any part of it. And their own fears and defenses, of course, played a role in how they had to isolate their children. They were not mean, despicable people. They were decent, ordinary parents trying to do their best. This was a chilling discovery that Lang and Esterson made from these interviews, to realize that you really can't lay the blame specifically at anyone. You know, the closer you look at families, the more you realize that, well, all families are a little crazy, you know, even the ones that don't have so-called schizophrenic members in them. They did studies of so-called sane families and well, and found that the dynamics were identical. So, you know, we don't really know what why it is, you know, that some of us go to sea, as it were, and some of us somehow adapt and cope, you know, to this situation.
Now there's an incredible permissiveness, and maybe there isn't the kind of authoritarianism that Lang was identifying. So would you say that his critique still holds true today, even with the cultural changes around what's actually happening in families today?
Yeah, I can't say that I see any difference in it at all, whether parents are authoritarian on the one extreme or permissive. You still see the same family dynamics. You still see people losing their minds. Now, some people would argue, oh, well, that must say that it's all genetic. You know, if it doesn't make any difference what happens in the culture, it just must be a biological disease entity that we haven't been able to isolate. As you well know, there's no evidence whatsoever that there is any kind of genetic component to any kind of mental attitude or state of mind. But it is a mystery as to why some people cope better than other people. An even bigger issue, of course, is once someone has lost their way, what's going to help them? And you're right, you know, John Perry, I Ward, there are a number of places like Soteria who all followed this model. Let's not medicate them. That was the heart and soul of the strategy. Why throw that at them? Let them just try to cope the best they can without medication. Some people could do that in their home environment. Some people needed a special environment because the parents were too threatened or afraid or out of their depth. Often you needed someone around this person like 24 hours a day to protect them and make sure nothing bad happens to them and just let them get through it. So that was the idea. And I think that that model has had proven to have significant success, all of them, even though they had very different strategies and very different ways of working at it. Just not giving medication and giving people a place to stay for as long as they needed. Most people that had that opportunity at Lang's work never went back to a mental hospital again. That, to us, was the real litmus of success. Not giving them some kind of mental inventory exam and saying, now, how many symptoms do you still have, etc. As long as you can cope and get along with people, which is the biggest problem I think most people have that get marginalized, then you've got a life. And that's what it's about, is giving you a life, not just you know, making you more acceptable to society's views of how you're supposed to be.
One of Lang's quotes is, We respect the voyager, the explorer, the climber, the spaceman. Why is it we do not respect the mad, who are often exploring the inner space and time of consciousness? I think that one of the key things here is that it's really, and this is maybe one of the messages of existentialism too, that only by encountering these struggles inside of yourself, by having some familiarity with these experiences of alienation and adapting to normalized violence, only by encountering them in ourselves, then can we then go on and help other people by understanding the mutuality and the common struggle. We don't have a lot of time left in the interview, Michael. Why don't you just give us the contact information if people want to find out more about Gnosis Retreat, if they want to find out more about the R.D. Lang and the 21st Century Symposium at Esalen, they want to get in touch with you. Give us the contact information.
Oh, I'd be happy to, Will. People can email me at michaelguy@mac.com. I also have a website, www.michaelguythompson.com. We have a website for our Gnosis Retreat Center, which is Gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, retreatcenter.org. And that lays out all the information and contact information you would need if you're interested in being a client or helping to donate or give support in any other way.
Michael Guy Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Guy Thompson. He's a psychoanalyst who trained with the Scottish psychiatrist R.D. Lang. He is the author of The Death of Desire. He's a teacher and trainer and on the faculty of the California Institute of Integral Studies and the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California. Michael is the director of the R.D. Lang in the 21st Century Seminars at Esalen Institute, and he's the founder of the Gnosis Retreat Center in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archivist. This contract position will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms, all kinds of audio formats, as well as the document and electronic archives. Priorities for this position are to manage the resource space archival database, in particular the entry of metadata, and to support staff and volunteers during the 50th anniversary celebrations. Deadline for this position is Monday, February 5th, 2018 at 5 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/archivist-hire-2018.
February 13, 1983, KBOO Community Radio held an open house to celebrate moving into a building that we could come to own here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us Tuesday, February 13th for the 35th anniversary of the open house moving-in party. Food, drinks, tours, and memories will be on hand as we celebrate 35 years in this building and 50 years of KBOO. That's the 35th anniversary open house, Tuesday, February 13th, 5 to 8 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing, boing.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, February 5th, 2018. in Washington, D.C., and more than 24 states across the country on Monday, supporters of the Poor People's Campaign and National Call for Moral Revival gathered to kick off 40 days of moral action. The campaign aims to highlight the human impact of policies which promote systematic racism, poverty, the war economy, and environmental devastation. In Salem, supporters of the campaign submitted a list of demands to state legislators as the 2018 legislative session kicked off today. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, under the leadership of Trump Budget Chief Mick Mulvaney, has reportedly placed its investigation of Equifax on ice. 143 million Americans had their personal information compromised in a massive security breach last year. The consumer advocacy group Public Citizen wrote in response to the news that Mulvaney appears intent on protecting the company instead of consumers, highlighting the fact that Mulvaney has received thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from Equifax, corporate watchdog Allied Progress decried the Bureau's move as deeply disturbing. The Center for Biological Diversity has threatened to sue the U.S. State Department for failing to release an overdue climate report. Today, the Center warned Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to produce the overdue U.S. Climate Action Report or face a lawsuit. The deadline to submit the report to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change Secretariat passed on January 1st. The center noted that the state's department failure to submit the report by the deadline constitutes a violation of both the UN Treaty and the Federal Administration Procedure Act. In Oregon news, today's State of the State speech by Governor Kate Brown focused on education and the plan to increase Oregon's graduation rates in the coming year. She laid out her plan to improve technical education and training programs so more Oregonians can land jobs in growth industries such as bioscience and healthcare. The governor noted that businesses currently tap out-of-state candidates to fill out one of every four job openings in Oregon's technology industry and one out of every five jobs in advanced manufacturing. The speech launched the 35-day legislative session Monday. That's it for the KBOO News at Noon. Tune in today and every weekday at 5 p.m. for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer reporters in our Portland studios. For KBOO News at Noon, I'm Nicholas Shane.
And you are tuned to KBOO.